of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on a beautiful Monday afternoon here in Juneau, March 4th, 2019. Present are Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Giesel, Senator Keel, and myself, Chairman Birch. See no legislators in the audience. I'd remind everyone to silence your cell phones. We have two items on today's agenda. Consideration of Jerry Burnett, the governor's appointee to the Board of Game, will be first up. And then following that will be a presentation entitled Building Alaska's Blue Economy by the Alaska College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Up first, we have, again, a governor appointee to the Board of Game, Jerry Burnett, from right here in Juneau. This is Mr. Burnett's first time being appointed to the board, and his appointment, if confirmed, would be through June 30 of 2021. The Board of Game's main role is to conserve and develop Alaska's wildlife resources. This includes establishing open and closed seasons, areas for taking game, setting bag limits, and regulating methods and means. The board is also involved with setting policy and direction for the management of the state's wildlife resources. The board is charged with making allocative decisions, and the Department of Fish and Game is responsible for management based on those same decisions. Mr. Burnett, thank you very much for coming to the table. Please state your name for the record and give us a little more about yourself and your qualifications.
Chairman Birch and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I was appointed to the Board of Game by Governor Dunleavy on February 22nd, and I'm asking for your positive consideration for my confirmation. In past years, I've had the pleasure of working with each of you in my role as a member of the executive branch. Today, I want to tell you more about myself and why I will be a good member of the Board of Game. I grew up in rural western Washington state and hunted and fished with my father and five brothers at an early age. I got my first fishing pole at age four. My mother taught me how to shoot and to respect firearms starting at age six, and I had my first gun at age 10. I've carried on a tradition of hunting and fishing, and you will find moose, caribou, and deer antlers displayed at our home, along with a variety of African plains game, and usually find venison, moose, often caribou, bison, and elk in the freezer, along with the salmon, halibut, lingcod, and spot prawns. My wife and I, and our oldest son and I, enjoy hunting together. We all like eating wild game, and we all hope to have the chance to hunt with our grandchildren in the future. Since moving to Juneau in 1981, I have worked in a number of jobs, including as a real estate broker, a business instructor at University of Alaska Southeast, a charter boat captain, had 12 years as a staffer to the legislature, and 15 years as a director and or deputy commissioner for the Murkowski, Palin, Parnell, and Walker administrations. I retired as the deputy commissioner of Department of Revenue in December of 2017. My wife and I still have a charter boat business, and we do multiple day overnight fishing charters in northern southeast on our 58-foot boat. Beginning in the 1990s, I became involved with the Alaska Outdoor Council and served on the board as the Southeast Vice President starting in 2000 and as the Alaska Outdoor Council President in 2002 and 2003. Served many years on the board of directors of Territorial Sportsmen in Juneau, including 4 years as the president. Many of you have attended our joint Territorial Sportsman Alaska Outdoor Council fundraising banquets here, which I have emceed. Over the past 20 years, I've been deeply involved with the issues which are near and dear to hunters and anglers in Alaska. I've authored and co-authored comments and proposals to the boards of Fish and Game, sometimes working through the local Fish and Game Advisory Committee process. I've authored and co-authored comments on federal and state legislation and proposed regulations concerning access to federal lands, the state's right to manage its resources, and on a variety of land use proposals. In my previous state positions, I've served on a number of boards, and so go into this with an appreciation of the process of hearing and considering public comments and testimony before making decisions and adopting regulations. As you know, Section 8 of the Alaska Constitution provides in part that wherever occurring in their natural state, fish, wildlife, and waters are reserved to the people for common use, and that fish, forests, wildlife, grasslands, and all other replenishable resources belonging to the state shall be utilized, developed, and maintained on the sustained yield principle, subject to preferences among beneficial uses. In accordance with the statutory framework developed by the legislature and codified in Title 16, it is the role of the Board of Game to consider the science developed by the Department of Fish and Game, and the input from the public to set regulations, seasons, and bag limits that will ensure that Alaska's wildlife resources are utilized on the sustained yield principle. I believe that I'm well qualified to be a part of that process as a member of the Board of Game. Thank you. I'll be happy to respond to any questions from the committee.
Thank you very much for your comments and presentation, Mr. Burnett. I would just note for the record at 3:32, we're joined by Senator Reinbold and Senator Bishop. Questions from committee members? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for stepping up to this job, Mr. Burnett. When you consider the concept of maximum benefit when we're talking about wildlife, how would you define that in terms of allocation?
Well, through the chair to Senator Giesel, the legislature has made many definitions already. So we have to start the Board of Game with each game population has to start with the subsistence benefit in almost all areas of the state. There's some non-subsistence areas, but for maximum benefit of game, it is going to be, in my opinion, preserving the harvestable surplus that can be used for human consumption, for one thing, and also there's a number of different uses depending on where in the state these are, how easily people can access the game populations. So in some cases, the maximum benefit for a population may have to do with professional guided hunts. You know, that might be with brown bears on Chichagof Island. That might be the most beneficial use of that because that's going to be important to people on an economic basis that are maybe the same people that are eating the deer there or eating deer someplace else. So it's complicated. You have to look at, and that's why it's so important to take the public comment to understand the various uses and how they're used in each community and by each user group.
Very good.
One
other question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how many years has it been since a Southeast member was appointed to this board? Do you know?
Through the chair, I'm not sure. It's been a number of years.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two. Thank you for bringing yourself forward. How do you feel about cow moose hunts?
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, there are populations where you get an imbalance between cows and bulls, and you have habitat degradation as a result of having too rapidly a growing population. Each year, the Board of Game has to look at each one of those antlerless hunts and authorize it or not authorize it. Without looking at the specific hunt, I don't have a feeling about this because they're clearly beneficial for use of food if that's what's needed to keep the population properly balanced in the area.
Follow up. So, provided you get seated, you were quoting, and the input from the public to set regulations. So, how much I would like to think that you will pay attention and listen to the public. While the department may have the science, there's a lot of people that are in the field that have been in the field, and there's more of hunters than there are ADF and G people that are in the field and keep good field notes, not anecdotal, but good field notes. And I would hope that you would listen to what the people have to say. Thank you. That wasn't really a question, but can you answer that?
I certainly would do that. No,
thank you. Senator Reinbold.
So I've looked at some research, and about 10% of the people swerve from hitting a moose on the highways, or several of them are getting in significant car accidents. There is research also that shows that the moose are attracting the bears into our school grounds, our trails, our homes, our yards, our area. It's a really important issue for my community. We have loads of grizzlies and black bears and moose in our area, and it's become a public safety concern. So where do you stand on managing public safety over a lot of the fish and game people right now want to just manage the people and just slap fines on them? And my community is pretty annoyed by managing the people and not the wildlife. I just want to know, one, how you would manage wildlife in heavily used user areas, and number two, in regards to public safety, how would you manage situations in that?
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, without looking at the very specific situation, I don't have the same level of knowledge about your typical your community as you do. So I can't speak to what needs to be done in your community, but certainly would consider public testimony on that. My personal feeling is that a person is much more valuable than any game animal. So if you are looking at a choice of managing a population for additional public safety, and that's a necessary, it appears to be a necessary thing, I'm not opposed to that in any way, shape, or form, and certainly would be in favor of it.
Follow-up?
Can I interject my opinion?
You can have a follow-up question if you have a follow-up question.
So basically, I'm just telling you, there's a lot of people in my community mm-hmm. that definitely are very concerned about the number of grizzlies right. and the black bears and things like that. So just ensuring that public safety is and people, and I would have to agree with you, you know, is kept of the highest. Because when I was raised around Anchorage, there were not bears in the community. And my mm-hmm. husband was raised on the Chugach foothills. It was managed far differently than a massive transition in the 90s that have caused, like, incredible numbers. So just keep the people's at the center, you know, their Thank safety.
Thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before my question, I can answer Senator Giesel's question. Too many years. Couldn't resist. But the question I had for Mr. Burnett, the system of advisory councils, advisory committees around the state is a lot of Alaskans really put a lot of value in it. They actually cost a fair amount of money. What is your view of the best way for the Board of Game to interact with or use those committees or not consolidate? What's your approach?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, there's currently 84 fish and game advisory committees in different regions of the state. And as you said, they're expensive. Fish and game, you know, game management is self-supporting at the you know, your hunting license fees, which went up this year, will, you know, pay for that, we hope. There are proposals for a joint fish and game board meeting coming up here in March where we're going to be discussing some changes to some of the advisory committees where it makes it more convenient for people to actually get together in a community. As you say, that's an incredibly important part of the process, and so I think we need to look at how to make it work best. Now proposals all go out to the advisory committees and then come back to the board. You know, they go out to advisory committees and to the department, come back to the board, and the board makes decisions on proposals or amends them or whatever. But that advisory committee, I agree with you, is very important.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Burnett. With that, we will open a public testimony on the appointment of Jerry Burnett to the Board of Game. First, is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing no one, go to our online folks, and let's see, I think we'll start with Rod Arno. The Alaska Outdoor Council. Mr. Arno, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me, Senator Buzz?
Loud and clear, sir.
Yes, proceed. All right. Well, thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify. My name is Rod Arno. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Outdoor Council and representing 47 clubs statewide, which Territorial Sportsman's one of them, and about 10,000 Alaskans. Personally, I've participated in the Board of Game process for the last three decades for the Outdoor Council, and I have strong opinions on what I think would make a good Board of Game member, that the allocation issue is the most important that we deal with. As far as conservation, the department has always been good about that. But having a person like Jerry Burnett, who is knowledgeable of the process before going and sitting on the board, is very important to the Alaska Outdoor Council's board of directors. And actually, the Outdoor Council is representing the folks, as Jerry pointed out, that are paying our own way on this. So having a seat at the table at the Board of Game is extremely important to users who buy hunting and fishing license. Thank you for your time, and hopefully you'll pass his name on out of committee for confirmation.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Arno. If there's any questions, I see none. Next, we move to Mark Richards, resident hunters of Alaska and Fairbanks. Mr. Richards, can you hear us?
I can. Thank you, Chairman Birch and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Richards. I'm the executive director of Resident Hunters of Alaska. I'm representing some 2,000 Alaskans from across the state who support a resident hunting priority. As I mentioned in a note to the committee earlier, we have not got the chance to meet with Mr. Burnett yet. I'm hoping Mr. Burnett is listening to meet with him in a couple days here in Juneau. We want to find out more about him. I'm very glad to hear his answers about Article 8 of our Constitution and maximum benefit. I did want to tell the committee that we had recommended either a South Central or a Southeast member for this seat. Currently, there were no South Central or Southeast members, but we had also recommended David Brown from Wrangell. And I would remind the committee that he did serve on the board from 2014 till 2017. And he was not reappointed by Governor Walker in 2017, but we did have a Southeast member on the board, and it was a very valuable seat to get input from Southeast. Anyway, in closing at this time, we can't make any recommendations, but again, we're looking forward to meeting Mr. Burnett, and we'll send on our opinion at a later date. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon, Mr. Richards. I don't see any questions. I don't see anyone else signed up to testify online. Reconfirm there's no one in the audience that wishes to testify. And with that, we will close public testimony. Thank you for your participation. If there are no further questions or comments from the committee members at this point, we'll pass around the signing sheet, which for the record reads, in accordance with AS 3505080, the Senate Resources Committee has reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Board of Game, Jerry Burnett, Juneau. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. With that, we'll take a brief at ease as we sign the paperwork, and then we'll reconvene here momentarily for a UAF College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences presentation. That we are back on the record. As mentioned earlier, we have the University of Alaska Fairbanks College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences here. They're going to give us some perspective on how our university system plays a key research and workforce development role in Alaska's marine industries. We have in front of the room here Dr. Brad Moran, Dean, and head of the College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair and committee members, for your time today. It's a pleasure to be here speaking on behalf of the College of Fisheries and Ocean Science. I wanted to really use this title, Building Alaska's Blue Economy, to give the main message of the value of CFOS and the return on investment of CFOS to the state of Alaska. I'd welcome questions as we move along, and with that, I'll proceed. Thank you. A couple of summary slides. First, to start out, we are a statewide entity. We are literally all over the map. We have 12 locations. 11 of those are all on coastal communities. We are the largest academic research and academic unit in Alaska, in the sense that we are geographically very diverse and we have a very large budget. We are next in line after Geophysical Institute last year fiscal year with $46 million in expenditures, which are almost entirely in the state of Alaska, other than when folks are traveling or doing research outside. I just wanted to highlight one point on that budget donut, if you like, and that is that last fiscal year we received $5.9 million investment from general fund from the state, and the output was $46 million in expenditures. Our president was here a few weeks ago noting a 6-to-1 return on that dollar investment. Ours is an 8-to-1, so go CFOS. The other part is $22.8 million in research is almost entirely federal. And the other big green blob there on that donut is $11.3 million in Sikuliak, which I will highlight more, I can talk about now, and that is from the National Science Foundation that we are awarded every year to operate that vessel. I've listed in bullet form our primary research and economic drivers. These are our facilities, our centers. Starting at the top, this is in alphabetical order. Alaska Sea Grant, you may be well familiar with this excellent program. It's a partnership with NOAA and the state of Alaska. That is actually housed in the College of Fisheries and Ocean Science. That director reports to the dean, to me. We have a number of coastal institutes and facilities, the Coastal Marine Institute, the Kitsissna Bay Lab, the Kodiak facility. I'm going to talk about these, but I wanted to list them out. Ocean acidification, a growing concern, particularly in high latitude cold waters such as offshore of Alaska. Our Erasmus and Fisheries Research Center, and lastly, our Sikuliak vessel that we operate, plus the Seward Marine Center. So the reason I point these out is this is a significant asset that we have in this college that deals with the fisheries, marine biology, and oceanographic challenges that we face in a very rapidly changing environmental system. It's a huge asset that we have such reach and expertise across the state in some of these areas. Sorry.
Before you move off on that slide, two questions, and you don't have to answer them now, especially if you're going to address them along the way. But because of the ocean acidification issues and really the migration of fish and what we do in high seas fisheries, we end up having to work with Washington State for the most part, British Columbia, Hawaii, Korea, Japan, on our sciences. Can you tell me what the university is doing to work with them? I see where you have federal input, but we see ourselves, I think you do too, as the guardians of the North Pacific and the Arctic, but we also have to share it with all these folks. Can you tell me the $46 million is how much compared to what other states are doing, and are we having good collaboration?
Through the chair, in a general sense, I would first point out that really CFOS is a resource to the state. It provides unbiased information and education and workforce training around fisheries, ocean, and marine biology. So we're a state resource in that regard, but we're also a strong resource to our colleagues in other states, as you noted, and other countries, for example, British Columbia, Canada. I mean, we can certainly respond in more detail on some of the particulars of that, but I would just argue that we have a very, very competitive, strong program, and we are in the top five. The fact that we operate Sikuliak puts us on par or more with, say, the state of Washington, for example, that also operates a global-class vessel.
Mr. Chairman, we met with the Consul General of Japan the other day, mm-hmm. and Japan falls into one of our largest customers when it comes to seafood, for sure. But China as well, Korea as well. But the production base is Alaska, British Columbia, for the most part, what we do. And with your research, I'm just trying to figure out where our arms reached or where they joined. And maybe with the federal dollars, you can explain to me, do we compete with federal dollars or do we complement with federal dollars what other North Pacific areas are doing?
Through the chair, of course, the primary funder being, say, NOAA or National Science Foundation, I mean, that is an open competition through regular or solicited calls for proposals that any organization in the U.S. can compete for. So we are competing in that regard, if that's addressing your question. But we work together in the sense that folks are on the management council from, you know, other places than just Alaska, for example. We interact regularly on an international basis with many entities. So I hope that that federal dollar, and actually, frankly, the state investment to leverage that federal dollar, the important point, is far-reaching. It's collaboration with other states. But I'm not sure if I'm completely addressing. Are we competitive compared to those states? Absolutely. But I'm not sure if it's the return on investment, say, for state of Alaska or Oregon State. Canada has a completely different system for funding, of course, than we do. But I'm not sure if I'm hitting that for you.
Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to belabor it, but since we do so much research, I want to know how much we are reaching out. And then some of our consumers probably could afford to kick in since they demand high quality. And then the quality is not totally dependent on what Alaska does. It's just, for example, I know some years we were interested in the mercury content, and we did everything we could, but there were some things just out of our control, and we went about to do what we could nationally and internationally about that. So those are the kind of things I was thinking about.
I mean, we, through the chair, are absolute leaders, in particular, since we're talking about fisheries, there's no question, national, international leaders in fisheries across the board, whether it's shellfish, kelp, or actual fisheries, finfish fisheries. I mean, that is well recognized, and we're highly competitive, but we collaborate. I mean, our faculty work with many other faculty, of course, and many other institutions. So it's collaborative yet competitive.
I just wanted him to say that out loud, too, that we are world-renowned, and we don't want to give that place up.
No. I speak on behalf of CFOS and the university. We're very proud of what we've accomplished. I mean, it is an outstanding fisheries department, with no question. And there are many examples, and I might hit on some of them as I move through the presentation, but please do interrupt and ask for that.
Thank you.
Forward. This may speak to your point, Senator. So I wanted to highlight in the context of a blue economy industry partnerships. We have a number of industry partnerships. I wanted to highlight right here the cooperative with the at-sea processors, Trident, Aleutian Spray, American Seafood, Glacier. This cooperative is the largest philanthropic donor, the University of Alaska in Marine Science. It's through 2019, approximately $16 million. That money goes to support students, research, workforce training. It also supports the Ted Stevens Chair in Marine Policy that we hold in our college. So this is an excellent example of industry supporting and working hand-in-hand with our college, in this case around fisheries. Federal agency partnerships, I've mentioned one in Sikuliak, which I'll highlight again, but Alaska Sea Grant is an excellent example of a solid partnership with the with NOAA. This is a statewide entity, Sea Grant. It's in CFOS. They have roughly a $1.5 million budget from NOAA. We match that by requirement of on 50 cents on the dollar. So we support Alaska Sea Grant. They are really our primary outreach arm to coastal communities. They are the reach across the state that is on that map in the second slide primarily. Department of Interior Ocean Energy Management Bureau has just doubled their input into the Coastal Marine Institute from $500,000 to $1 million this year. That's really a virtual institute. It's not a bricks and mortar. But we have $1 million that we use annually to support primarily student research, some faculty research that guides that as well. And there are other examples, but all of this leverages that 1-to-8 ratio I referenced to support research and Alaska's coastal communities in particular. I wanted to highlight a couple of examples on innovation and commercialization. Much of the research that we do of that $46 million is what we'd call basic research, hypothesis testing, et cetera. But applied side research is something we are absolutely part of, and fisheries is a logical example of that. Blue Evolution is a company that leases space from us at Kodiak, our Kodiak Seafood Marine Science Center, that they're using that to process kelp for market. They make seafood products. I just took a snapshot off the web there of their penne made from this kelp. Another is the salsa that you may be familiar with, the salsa. So they're using our facility at Kodiak. That's a great operation. It's gone on for, I think, 2 years now. We're into our third. And so that is a, you know, an example of our folks working hand-in-hand with a private corporation in this field of mariculture, which is a real opportunity for the state of Alaska. The Blue Pipeline Incubator is a partnership that we just started this last few months based at Seward, and that is supported externally with funding from, I believe, the town of Seward and some other support lines, that is a incubator to foster workforce and business, basically a along the lines of a research park, an incubator for technology innovation. So that is moving along very nicely. We're also working with the Department of Energy on this Mariner program. That is an award that we've received. We're lead PI on that. We work very closely with Southeast, actually, is driving that, University of Southeast. There are many other partners in the lower 48, but that's effectively to develop versions of the sugar kelp for market, and that is an opportunity that has considerable upside potential. And lastly, I'll point out, the pet treats that we make from fish skins that are developed at Kodiak. One of our faculty working out there has developed these commercializable pet treats from fish skins that dogs tell me they like them the best. There are many other examples, though. I did want to highlight on one slide mariculture. I think we're familiar with the opportunity with Alaska having more coastline than the rest of the lower 48 combined. There's a tremendous upside potential there for non-fish, fin fish aquaculture, kelp, shellfish, and I've highlighted some of the facilities that we'd have. For example, Kodiak, we are doing that now. Kitsissna Bay is a partnership with NOAA on kelp and invertebrate ecology. The Seward Marine Center I mentioned with the Blue Pipeline, and then Lena Point here in Juneau is engaged heavily in mariculture activities, both the faculty and the students. The active mariculture research, I've really just summarized in two bullets for brevity, but the Mariner program, I pointed out, that's a big deal. You may recall Senator Murkowski getting out front of this announcement that we had about a year or so ago. And we have a number of faculty and students working on kelp, crabs, ocean acidification that will impact mariculture going forward in the state of Alaska. There are some numerics put around the potential for Alaska in that space, anywhere from $100 million to you pick, but it's really an opportunity for particularly subsistence communities to engage in a new business venture in that regard, given the coastal opportunity. Sikuliak is an incredible asset. It's the largest federal asset, research asset in the state that we operate. It is the only ice capable, and that means that it goes through, that's defined by going through 2.5 feet of ice at 2 knots. It is not an ice breaker. It's an ice capable vessel. Some numbers up there. It's not a cheap vessel. It's $200 million. It's owned by the National Science Foundation. Since March 2014 through 18, we had an operating contract through a cooperative agreement with NSF. Last year, we were successful in renewing that through 2023 for $33 million. So I want to be clear, that vessel is paid for by the National Science Foundation. We do not pay to operate that vessel. There is no cost associated with that vessel with the university. The only input that we put into it budgetarily is an increment every year to show the NSF that we mean business, and that's some support for shift days on our side. But not only does it pay the crew, the captain, the food, the fuel, it pays for half of our financial manager at our university, in our college, which she does finance for the whole college, not just the Kuliak. It pays for a half-time person to interact with subsistence communities, a liaison. It pays all the salary costs of our port captain based in Seward, and it pays three-quarters of the cost of our marine superintendent to operate and function in our Seward Marine Center. So it is a very significant financial investment coming back to Alaska, to the university. The indirect cost recovery alone for that vessel annually is about $1 million to our college, and that's a significant amount of revenue. I would also point out that 2023 date, we're good through that, and we are operating this very well. We're on constant good communication with NSF. They're very happy with operating this significant vessel, but it will be competed federally, nationally in 2023. That's a mandate. And so we will have to write a proposal to re-up that for another 5 years, et cetera, going forward. That means we need to have good shoreside facilities, good operations, sort of clean bill of health, if you like. So you never take anything for granted. This is an absolute gem, a jewel for the state of Alaska. That it's like the gift that keeps on giving. It's a real point of pride. It raises the bar of this university in a significant way in ocean science research. Frankly, it's one of the reasons I moved here. So, yes.
Yeah, thank you, Dean. I just had a question regarding, as we talked earlier, the Coast Guard, Senator Murkowski, I believe it was, and Senator Sullivan announced that the Coast Guard has some very significant investments in Coast Guard infrastructure, facilities, cutters, and a new icebreaker. How does this measure up age-wise? And, I mean, is it obviously a different branch, but do they collaborate, or how do they work together, or do they work together?
So the Coast Guard is run out of Homeland Security, and that's a mission agency that has a mission, and that's to protect our coasts. This vessel is for enabling discovery and research. And it can be contracted, by the way, internationally. I'll have a slide on that. We've had the Office of Naval Research use this vessel, so the Navy has used this vessel. It can support a wide range of capabilities internationally. It can be used for methane hydrate work, for example, exploration, oil and gas play on that as well. Its day rate is $50,000 per day. Anyone is enabled to use that vessel.
Okay. A follow-up would be just regarding accessibility to all of Alaska's coastline, and obviously we've got a lot of coastline, and most of the fishery-related work, I understand, would be largely maybe south of the Aleutian chain. How far around the state does this vessel function? And I'm thinking 2 feet of ice. That amazes me that's just kind of a happenstance. It just that seems pretty remarkable to me to have that capacity.
Yes, I agree. We have an annual report that I can provide you, and the ship cruise track for all of the last calendar year or fiscal year is in that. But it's really going where the investigators propose to do research. That's what the driver is. It's called a global class vessel because it can go anywhere. It is designed for this northern operating, but it's been down to Mexico. It's been to Hawaii. It was potentially going to go to a geologic program in New Zealand. So if you wrote a proposal and you wanted to use it in the Greenland Sea, in principle, we could go over the top and into the Greenland Sea. The only place it cannot go is when you got heavy ice greater than 2.5 feet thick. Thank you.
Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean Moran, so the NSF awards university how much each year to operate, maintain, run
the chair? Approximately 11 or 12 million. It was 11.3 million in FY18.
11.3 FY18. So that, if I, just to follow up, the daily rate's 50,000.
Yeah. So we operate optimally.
Again, that amount.
Correct. Yeah. So we operate optimally. The day rate varies on how many days. 12 million, 11 million is approximately what NSF believes was needed to operate that vessel. That's not the entire year. So we'll have Navy. In fact, right now we're billing Navy, I think, 2.2 million. That's additional revenue on top of the cooperative agreement. Canada paid, I forget right now, they charted it for 3 weeks a couple of years ago. The European Union right now is put $500,000 toward operation of the vessel for 7 days. So I can absolutely get you, you know, more numbers and more data on how the day rate translates to the $11 or $12 million, if that's what you're getting at. Easily get that for you.
Thank you.
Thank great. You. Thank you. And yeah, be happy to send it to us, and we'll make sure we get it to the committee members.
Okay.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thanks. I wanted to show a couple of examples of the value that the college brings to understanding ecosystem function in coastal waters, ocean waters. This is a Northern Gulf of Alaska long-term ecosystem research program that just started a year ago. It's funded by the National Science Foundation. In a nutshell, these are exceptionally hard to get. Alaska, that is LTERs, that is. We have four of them in Alaska. Tulik is one. This new Northern Gulf is another one. We also have one in the Beaufort Lagoons. I wanted to highlight this partly because Sikuliak will enable this program greatly. So the black dots there are 45 years of research along the GAC-1 line, 20-year time series in particular. So that set the stage, if you like, for the expansion of this program with all the blue dots. It's roughly $2.5 million in research and ship time annually, and the goal is ultimately to understand changes in the ecosystem that will affect commercial fisheries. This program will go at least 10 years. Typically, LTRs are maybe 10, 20 years at least. Yeah,
Senator Bishop.
Just briefly, you said something that piqued my interest. You said Tulik. Are you talking about the Tulik Research Station north of the Attigan Pass?
Yes, the Tulik Research Station. That's a long-term ecosystem research station.
Thank you.
Yep.
Proceed.
On the international stage, of which, to Senator Coghill, we're certainly engaged and known internationally. But this is a unique one that came up a couple of years ago. I wanted to point out EU, an acronym for the European Union. It's the Arctic Research Icebreaker Consortium. You can see the vessels up there are, you know, Germany, Sweden, Norway, the Podiebeck Moatface, a.k.a. David Attenborough from England, the Amundsen, and Sikuliak. And so Sikuliak is in there with all the major players that are polar icebreaker operators. We're the actually only non-icebreaker up there. That's a big deal. We receive funding from the Blue Growth Strategy of the Horizon 2020 initiative in the EU. That's a challenge to get that. But it puts CFOS and Sikuliak on that international stage. This is really a point of pride for the college and for Alaska, frankly. There's so much that one could say about our graduates, but in the space of time, I just wanted to zero in our fisheries graduate in Alaska's economy, and there are just a few bullets I think folks are pretty familiar with here. Alaska provides roughly two-thirds of the nation's seafood protein landings. It's enormous. Best-managed fishery, arguably, in the country, perhaps the world. Over $4 billion in wholesale value and 60,000 workers. That's the largest private employer for the state of Alaska. On the sports side, just to point out that it's roughly $1 billion, give or take, on trip-related expenditures, supporting numerous jobs in the state of Alaska, and it has important customary and traditional uses of fishery resources. You'll note that the two individuals there depicted are young ladies. I did want to point out, I'd watched the presentation by our Dean Schnabel at this committee, and I'm very proud to say that 47% of our faculty are women in the College of Fisheries and Ocean Science. We've also had hundreds of graduate students, master's and PhD, in fisheries, and half of them are still working here, many at Fish and Game, working at Alaska, that is, Fish and Game and NOAA. That's a remarkable statistic to have that many graduate students graduate and stay in the state of Alaska in that particular industry and serve the state for those purposes. It's a great point of pride. being thrifty as we are, we have put out a new degree. I say new only in that we've put together what we already do in a format that meets a need that we believe, and that is an MBA that is wrapped around it called Blue MBA, and that is fisheries, seafood business, changing Arctic conditions. We have an online MBA with the School of Management, so I called that dean, Mark Herman, and said, let's do this and make it a Blue MBA. This is the only online MBA in fisheries ocean science in the world, certainly the U.S. It's unique then to University of Alaska. It's on the web. You can take this from New Zealand to Norway to Ketchikan to Anchorage to Juneau. Fully accredited MBA, and it is, as I note here, it's providing business solutions for a changing Arctic, whether they're in mariculture, whether in fisheries, whether in shipping, whether in ocean observing and forecasting of that nature. Quite excited about this program. On the one of two professional master's degrees we have, meaning working professionals that want to advance their career through a master's degree. I'm going to throw a few examples up here about that really just speak to the CFOS as a resource for the state, and in particular in fisheries. I'm highlighting fisheries. It's probably the most logical connection in that regard. This is a project. It's the longest time series of Arctic fishes anywhere. It started in 1985. It's funded by Hillcorp Energy. And that is looking at the fisheries dynamics in this area along the North Slope. One of our faculty just came back from a Hillcorp meeting last week, and they were so interested in this. This has been a summer project, as you can tell from that picture. They want to now fund a winter project because Arctic cod are spawning, et cetera, under the ice in the wintertime, and they want to expand. Hillcorp wants to expand their work up there and want to be sure they're in compliance, et cetera. So we're very excited with that partnership. That's another example of us working hand-in-hand with industry, in this case the energy industry and fisheries. Again, not doing a deep dive here. The dean is a chemical oceanographer, not a fishery scientist, but I'm conveying the great research that we do, in this case on management of longline fisheries that we've had to we've worked to readjust the stock assessments that allow pot gear now in Alaska and reduce bycatch and other matters. Any of these examples, I'm happy to get more detail on these for you. They're just intended to convey the value that we have in the breadth we have in our fisheries research. Well familiar with the year-at-age pollock decline in size. There's an example there. The average weight of a halibut, 20-year-old halibuts, declined from 120 to 45 pounds. Why is that? There's still active research on trying to figure that out, hence the question mark there with arrows going up, down, or not changing. But the outcome, though, is the International Pacific Halibut Commission is revising their stock assessments model based on our research. This is a big deal for Alaska. Halibut fishery is critical to our fishery. And that decline is significant, so we're actively working on research in that regard with our students. Tanner crab size. Many of the crabs never grow to the legal size or had not grown to legal size, resulting in a lot of discard and waste. So our research showed that we could lower the size limit, reduce that mortality, reduce the discard rate, and increase revenue and yields for the fishery. And so that was an outcome. The Board of Fish approved that proposal, reduced the size limit, improved the profitability of the tamar crab fishery. That's direct research from CFOS faculty and students. Hatchery release, another active area of research. This is a faculty member here at our Lena Point facility. In a nutshell, we worked hand-in-hand, actually, with DIPEC in Juneau. To optimize our hatchery strategies, make sure that we are able to ensure that a maximum sustainability of wild caught with hatchery fisheries.
Senator Bishop?
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question. Due to the low rainfall over the last 3 years, how is that negatively affecting the hatcheries here, particularly DIPAC, for instance, is right here in Juneau, and what is the What's the contingency plan if it continues that trend for releasing juvenile fish?
Through the chair, I'm going to defer to get back to you with some expert information on that question. I'm not the expert on that, but I would say that is a perfect example where we can be a resource for such questions. I think the prediction is difficult about what might happen in the future, but I know that that's an active area of research with our faculty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. You bet. Proceed.
Again, on the fishery research management, decline of Chinook salmon, abundance and size, a big deal. This is an interesting, if not entertaining, slide that's on my left, your right. That salmon shark slide you'll see on, and very, it may be a bit busy, but one of our faculty is using innovative tags that are tagged on a large Chinook and then followed by GPS to try and get a sense of their dynamics in the Gulf of Alaska. Well, that lower temperature profile is about 5 or 6 degrees. It hums along for several days, and it bumps up to 25 degrees centigrade, and then it drops down again. And that's not supposed to happen. That's because a salmon shark ate that fish, and they're warm-blooded, and the temperature jumped up to 25 degrees. And so in an inadvertent way, we're now, or that faculty is looking at with his students, is part of the reason the decline of Chinook from salmon shark predation. It's an open question. It wasn't known. And serendipitously, because of these tags being eaten and then actually shot out the other end, it provides a new area of research. That actual research is being funded by that cooperative that I referred to, the Pollock Conservation Cooperative. And the one on the right-hand side is effectively showing that the interaction of hatchery and wild fish, that's a critical question, right? We want to optimize the wild runs, and so the different timing, run timing, and the overlap on spawning grounds is an area of active research for Chinook. I'd like to just wrap up with this one last slide to show that we are really doing great things at CFOS, but there are other faculty in the University of Alaska Anchorage, University of Alaska Southeast, that are also engaged in fisheries. This is a professor who's working on at University of Alaska Anchorage research on shark jaws to develop various things that might have military application, prosthetic linings, et cetera. And we're a resource for policymakers with Sea Grant, fisheries economists. I mentioned the Ted Stevens Marine Chair. And Alaska Sea Grant, of course, is a great resource for that. They're having their big meeting right now in Washington, D.C., Sea Grant is. I'd just like to close with this image right here. This is a buoy that we have out there that is monitoring ocean acidification in our, one of our coastal embayments. And I hope that I left an impression of a great value to the state. We are certainly a good return on investment. We're operating some major facilities of international repute, and our students are coming out and working in Alaska and really driving forward this Alaska blue economy that I referred to. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much, Dean Moran. This is a great afternoon presentation, and a great update, and kind of makes me want to understand. You have a tour, or the ship is going to be in Seward sometime this summer?
Yes, sir. I can find the exact. We will find the exact date. It depends a little bit on scheduling, but it will be in Seward around the third week of May. If anyone would like to visit the ship, I'll help make it happen. It's a quick turnaround, but and they're a busy crew. But you know, we would like to have folks check it out.
Great. Questions, committee members?
One last thing.
Senator?
The buoy reminded me when Fukushima went up, we got a lot of stuff that just came over to the coast of Alaska, and there's a lot of cleanup, and it just reminded me that we become responsible for a lot of what the world dishes up. Is that something that that you all have been monitoring as well as the ocean acidification?
Through the chair, Fukushima?
No, just the stuff that floats into the coastline and how it affects our fisheries.
We are engaged in marine debris, Sea Grant and others, and we can certainly get more information on that for you. Yeah. We are actually not measuring Fukushima.
No, I wouldn't expect that. It's just that it had such a big impact, and so did some of the earthquakes, actually, in the Indonesian area. So.
Well, the only reason I mentioned the Fukushima is in my earlier life, I did measure Fukushima radioactivity coming up to the coast of North America, and I can send you that paper if you'd like. But anyhow, there's no threat. Don't worry.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much for a great presentation this afternoon. Thanks for coming to Juneau and helping us out. This is very informative. The next committee meeting will be held at 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, March 6th for a presentation on Alaska's outdoor recreational industry. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 4:24 p.m.